Alright, starting here in section 2, Introduction to Abstract Data Types. What is a data type? A data type is a collection of both operations and a way of storing data. It's both. There are some built-in data types that you're already familiar with. Arrays, structures. We're going to be talking about classes in here. We're going to learn how to create, program, or define abstract data types, ADTs, linked lists, queues, stacks. In terms of thinking about data structures, there's two ways that you can look at them. One is from an application viewpoint, how they get applied to a particular problem. You could think of this as if you were using a two-dimensional array, you might be using it to represent pressure points upon a surface or something, or you might be using it to represent a maze, the layout of a maze, or the layout of buildings, or whatever. An abstract or logical view is sort of a generalized view of the data structure. It's how you apply it to different problems. You can think of the application viewpoint as sort of however it gets shaped and used in a particular program. The abstract or logical view is sort of a black box. You don't have to know how the abstract data type works in order to use it. How are two-dimensional arrays, for example, actually implemented by the compiler? Does it use a two-dimensional area of memory? No, because there is no such thing as a two-dimensional area of memory. So the compiler's got to be doing something funky in there that gives you the illusion of a two-dimensional area of memory. But you don't need to know that from just someone who's using the two-dimensional array. However, if you were actually given the task of writing the compiler, or writing the part of the compiler that handles two-dimensional arrays, the implementation of it, then you would have to sort of open that box up and look inside of it and figure out how to make this one-dimensional linear memory inside the machine appear to be a two-dimensional memory. We think of that as sort of a physical view of how things actually work inside of a computer box is the physical view, the actual representation, the actual organization. And in terms of just using them and not thinking about how they're actually implemented, that's just sort of a logical view. And that's a common organizational technique in programming languages. Here we've got taking the two-dimensional array viewpoint. There's the different views. You can think of it as just a table or a matrix, but then it gets applied to a particular program and it gets used in some meaningful way to a particular problem that's being solved. In terms of its physical view, well, it has to get stored sequentially. There has to be some kind of a mapping that maps the logical view that the programmer has of the X and Y coordinates, the row and column indices, to the one-dimensional linear memory that's inside the machine. If we think of the index limits for an array being L1 and U1 are the lower and upper index values for the first dimension, and L2 and U2 the lower and upper index values of the upper dimension. Now in C++, L1 and L2 are always zero. Arrays always start at index zero in C, but that's not true in other languages. That would mean the compiler writer could figure out the number of storage locations that they need with that other formula there, where they basically subtract the upper limit bound of the first index from the lower limit bound, add one, and multiply that by an analogous, basically the number of rows times the number of columns gives you the number of matrix locations that you're going to have, which will be the number of sequential locations that you need. Now, they actually, compiler writers that do this in terms of a physical viewpoint, they have two choices. They can either do what's called a column major representation or a row major representation. column major is done in languages like Fortran, and basically what they do is they take the columns of the matrix and they store those first. So the first column is stored in memory, then right after that is the second column, the third column, the fourth column, etc. That's opposed to doing a row major representation, which is what C and a bunch of other languages use, where they store the first row is stored in linear memory, then the second row follows that, the third row, etc. Now you might wonder, does this really make a difference? Most of the time, this does not make a difference. You can see here on slide 2.4, it shows you the calculation formulas that a programmer would use to compute up the address for a given location in the table. There's the logical view of this little 3x4 table over there. And in order to figure out the location of I and J in row major form, there's the formula. Beta represents the base address of the array. Beta is the first location in memory where the array, the first element of the array will be stored at. And the compiler has to determine that and keep track of it. But then it has to determine the size of the rows to skip, the size of a row and the number of rows to skip. And it then multiplies that by, I'm going to have to bring my laser pointer, I can see that. It then brings the, doesn't work, it's not long enough. It then basically multiplies the size of a row by the number of rows to skip, and then it goes out the number of columns. Okay? So in row major, it has to figure out the size of a row is really the number of columns, and it multiplies that by the number of rows. So it skips over those, and then it's at the beginning of that row, and then it has to figure out how many columns in that row to go over to get to the location. That's really how compilers do this. So that for every IJ indice that you've got for a two-dimensional matrix, it basically puts in the executable code to do that calculation for you based upon whatever the values of I and J are during execution. That's the way it does that. Now you might wonder, does this really make a difference at all? Does this really matter? Well, yes it does actually, as it turns out. I had a friend, believe it or not, who worked for the Navy a while back. This has been quite a few years ago. He worked for the Navy, and they were doing image processing, that's not in real time back in those days, of images that the satellites would take. And they were processing these images, which are really nothing but two-dimensional matrices. And they were actually grayscale. So every pixel, okay, which is every row column value, had a value from 0 to 255 grayscale. And this was basically a picture of the ocean, which was really nice, because the ocean is a nice unchanging background for the most part. And so they know that this picture was taken at time T0. And then they would look at another picture that was taken so many minutes later at time T1. Okay? And for the most part, which I haven't done a good job of drawing it up here, for the most part, those two images aren't going to change. The ocean is a pretty unchanging background. And so what they would do is they would subtract these two matrices. They would do matrix subtraction. And they'd end up with this other matrix. Well, if these pixel values doesn't change, they don't change from one time to the next, what are you going to have as a result? You'll have an array that's full of zeros. Unless, of course, you know, there was some Russian ship, for example. You know, it was down here and then it moved over to here. Now you're going to have some values that are non-zero. Okay? And so what you're going to do is you're going to zero in on those values. Okay, so you do this again, you apply some physics to the problem, and you figure out, okay, so they're traveling in this direction at this speed, so we need to lob our missile in over here at this time in order to say hello to them, okay? That was the job he had. Whether you liked it or not, that was the job he had. But unfortunately, it was taking them far too long to do this image processing. It would take them, I think, about an hour or so to process a large number of these images. And it was taking too long. And so, of course, taking an hour was too long turnaround time for the Navy. So taking the typical government approach, they pulled out a bigger hammer, okay? They threw money at the problem, in other words. And they went out and bought a machine that was like six times as fast. So now instead of taking an hour, it should have only taken 10 minutes. That's right. Okay, it should have only taken about 10 minutes. All right? So they got this new whiz-bang machine in at that time. They installed all the operating system, all the software. They got this baby set up. They pulled all of their code over. They compiled all of their code, They fed in the new images. They hit the button, they hit the execute button. 10 minutes went by and nothing happened. 20 minutes went by and nothing happened. An hour went by and nothing happened, okay? As far as they could tell, it was still running, but nothing was happening. After a few hours, they shut it down. They knew something was wrong, okay? Well, the question is, what was wrong? Well, it turns out that they had, back in those days, they were writing their program in Fortran. So they knew that Fortran stored things in column major form. So when they were actually doing their processing of an image, they were going down the columns to do the processing of the image. They would process the first column's pixels, then the second column's pixels, etc. Now, that meant that in terms of primary memory, where these columns were laid out, they were doing it sequentially. Here was the first column, then here was the second column, etc. Okay? But it turns out that they discovered, after some long searching, that the new compiler on this new machine, this new Fortran compiler, was actually storing its matrices, which meant the images, in row major form, which meant when they were going down the columns, they would, like, for example, they would process this pixel, then they would jump down here and process this pixel, this pixel, this pixel, okay? And then when they came back through and started doing the second column, then they would be jumping around again. So the question is, why does that make a difference? It takes longer to go through memory. So you're telling me that if I write a program to access memory location 1 million, it takes longer to access location 1 million than maybe 10 million, location 10 million? So you're telling me that there's a speed difference between one part of RAM and another part of RAM? There isn't, okay? You knew that, okay? From the way my tone of voice, of course you knew that. You knew I was trying to sucker you into saying yes, okay? There is none. Is it the jumping around in the RAM? No, not the jumping around in RAM. I mean, there may be, if you go to a fine enough level, there might be a small, small, small speed difference between accessing one location as opposed to another one because of the banking and et cetera that goes on with memory. But that speed difference is so minute that it's not worth even computing. Yeah, he said it may not be holding the entire image in RAM at one time. These were pretty big images. So why would that make a difference?
Because it would have to jump around back to a hard drive and then get
Exactly. Because of virtual memory, because of the paging that was going on in the system, it could not, these images were very big, and at that time memories weren't as large as they are now. And so they couldn't hold all of this image in primary memory. They couldn't hold all of these. Only part of the image was being held in memory at any given time. And so as they were going down sequentially through memory, they would be hitting all of it, and they would be hitting all of the stuff that was in memory until they eventually hit part that wasn't. And then it would transfer that out. It would swap the pages. But by jumping around in memory, they were hitting a lot more places on the image that wasn't in memory, and they were doing that time and time again. So basically, they've taken this new machine that was 6 times faster than the previous machine, and they slowed it down to the speed of their hard drive almost. Okay? And that's what was going on. Now, this is one case where knowing the implementation view was quite important. What you try and do as a programmer when you're coding up your own abstract data types is you actually try and code them up so that your user, which sometimes is yourself and sometimes other programmers, don't need to know that, and even if they do, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. You can't always achieve that goal, but that's one of your goals. All right. Last time we discussed in chapter 2 of the notes on the introduction to abstract data types, we discussed how you might view a two-dimensional array from 3 different aspects. How you could view it from an application aspect, if it was being used to represent a maze or surface points. How logically, in a general sense, to a user of a programming language, a two-dimensional array appears to be some matrix or table type of organization of memory. And then we also talked about viewing it from a physical point of view, from the actual implementation point of view of how a compiler writer has to view it, where a compiler writer has to come up with some mechanism for mapping the logical two-dimensional view of a programmer onto the one-dimensional memory that exists inside of a machine. We're going to continue with this discussion of these different views and different concerns with abstract data types today. Typically, we've talked about here, starting on slide 5 in chapter 2, we did discuss how an abstract data type is a combination of both a representation for some data and a set of operations, set of abstract operations. And you supply the user an interface which they can use to manipulate this data, which they can use to access it. And you wrap that around so that it's all packaged together in an abstract data type. Now, one of the key parts of abstraction in terms of ADTs and programming is this idea of separating the logical view of the user of what an abstract data type does from the actual physical implementation of how it works, how it gets implemented, how it gets represented. And that's a very powerful and pervasive view that we have to learn to adopt in our programming. Underneath it lies this concept of information hiding. The idea that a user doesn't really need to know at times how something works or how something is represented. We hide those details from the user. And that has a lot of benefits both from their perspective and from our perspective. From both viewpoints, from both the implementation view and the user's abstract logical view. If you can think about it, in order to solve complex problems, you have to be thinking at a certain high level in order to solve them. There are certain problems. If you can think about, well, what if your job was to implement an operating system? but all you had to work with was the binary representation machine language. Okay, it's almost an impossible task. You don't have the tools to think at, or to work at a high enough level to solve that job, to solve that task. And so by hiding details of an abstract data type of how things work, we basically provide a higher level of thinking and a higher level of tools for other programmers to use in our code. And we do that for ourselves also. When we're using the code ourselves, we can create this type, we can implement it, and then the rest of our code, we don't have to think about it anymore. And we're able to use it at a higher level without having to think of the details of implementation. Here on the next slide, down here at the bottom, is kind of a representation of this. At the heart, basically you can think of an abstract data type as being wrapped around with levels. At the heart of it is the actual storage for the abstract data type. Above that are some low-level ADT functions that are still part of the abstract data type. And they may be very low level, and they may be the only functions that can actually access and change the data that's in the ADT. We might then have another higher level set of functions which use these lower level set of functions to manipulate the ADT. We're going to see an example of this later on here in the semester. And then above that we have some abstract data type applications, user programs that get implemented using these high level ADTs. Now the advantage of having these different levels is several fold. One of the primary examples of this is in, let's say, databases. There are several large known, well-known databases that are being sold in throughout the world at the moment. Probably the largest is Oracle, the Oracle database, but there's several others. Sybase's Informix, IBM's DB2, Microsoft's SQL, Access, FoxPro, whatever, they've got a conglomeration of them. But companies buy these databases. And what comes with these databases are shielded from the programmers in the company by levels like this. They have the actual database that sticks out here on the hard drive, and then above that they have some low-level functions that only that the user isn't allowed to access, isn't allowed to call. And then they provide for the user these high-level ADT functions. The advantage of this is that at some point, let's say, you know, a year or so or 2 years down the road after they sell the thing to the company, that the technology changes. They change it, the technology changes, somebody comes up with a much faster hard drive, the operating systems change, the underlying file systems change to take advantage of this. And so the database people realize that they can take advantage of this, they can make their databases a lot faster, but they've got to change how they're going to represent things here on the hard drive. Well, all they do is they change that, and they change these low-level list functions. But the high-level list functions, they don't change what they do. They don't change what they do. They might change how they do it, but they don't change their interface. They don't change what parameters are passed to the functions or when you call them. They may add new functions to them, but they will maintain backward compatibility. They will keep all of their old functions with all of their old parameters. That way, then, they can then go out and tell a company, we've got this much faster version of our database for you. You give us up X amount of dollars, we'll sell you our new system, and our new system will work Y number of times faster. You'll be able to process things a lot faster, transactions on the web a lot faster. And companies, they will also, of course, usually they'll have some sort of secondary programs out here to translate the old database into the new format at the low level. But the big thing from the company's point of view, when they buy this, companies will then buy databases and they will then have their programmers, their own programmers, create their own application programs that sit on top of the database that manipulate the database for the specific way they do business. And when they're going to upgrade, they're not going to be willing, they really can't afford to rewrite all of their database applications that their programmers have developed. And so if the database company maintains this backward compatibility, maintains the interface, all of their other programs will just need to be recompiled and they'll still work. And you get that through these levels of abstraction here, and by separating how things are actually working from how it appears to be working from the user. And this idea of information hiding and abstraction gives us a lot of advantages Now, there's usually a slight difference made between encapsulation and information hiding. Some authors will define one the way the other authors define one. Some authors will define encapsulation as the ability, as restricting the access to a specified set of operations for an abstract data type. Other authors, I'll warn you, will call that information hiding. And they'll call encapsulation just the ability to collect things together and encapsulate them, refer to them by a common access mechanism. You don't really need to worry too much about the distinction. I'm not going to test you on the distinction between the two. They go hand in hand, though. Information hiding is this idea of hiding the implementation. And encapsulation is the idea of encapsulating both the data and the operations together. And then there's this other sort of language responsibility of denying access except through this set of operations. Some people will call that information hiding, some will call it encapsulation. Question?
Yeah, so if you which data is better? So the more the low level functions, the better the data expenses?
No, that's nothing to do with it. The low-level functions are only there so that it makes it easier for the database manufacturer to change how they're doing things at a very low level. And the higher level, it'll just make it easier for them. They could technically only have one level in here. They could tell the user, here's this one level. As far as the user sees, there is only one level. When a company buys a database and they give them, and another company like Oracle sells them the database and they sell them the programming libraries that go along with it, they only give them this, there's only this one set of libraries, this one level, as far as the programmers know. In reality, there's other levels, but they don't have access to them. And in reality, I mean, a company could technically just implement it with one level, but it would make things a lot more difficult on them. What would be a good analogy from a real-world perspective? Let's see. I don't really know. I don't know if that, but unfortunately I'm a programmer, and so I don't have enough knowledge in other areas to come up with some good examples. You could sort of think of it maybe from a hardware point of view. This has been going on for a while in a sense. When you buy a new machine, when Intel comes out with a new processor, their processors have been backward compatible now for quite a few generations, which means at least at the assembly language, machine language level, they support the same operation set as the previous processor. But in reality, you may not know about this, but they were also extended, of course. Okay, now that is one level of an interface to the processor. that they will maintain their backward compatibility, but they will add new operations so that newer programs can take advantage of it. But in reality, the machine language is actually represented in another language, in a micro language. The micro language is what controls the gate. The micro language actually, for an instruction, sets in the micro code in the ROM. And it actually controls the gates and with timing mechanisms that actually go on too. So that when, in order to carry out an add instruction, for example, or just to get data to flow from one register to another register, certain gates will have to be closed to open up that path. And those gates are all numbered. They're all basically controlled by zeros and ones. Zero, the gates open. One, the gates closed. And so you're actually to implement like an add instruction is a set of strings of zeros and ones. And these strings of zeros and ones in microcode will determine that they'll get put out through the controller, through the control unit, and the control unit will use that sequence of zeros or ones to close the gates that correspond to those zeros and ones. That'll let the current flow from one part to another. Then they'll take the next sequence and do that. Okay? Well, the advantage of doing it that way is that if they find some slight little problem at times, they could fix it without actually changing the hardware. And that's kind of an example of these different levels that exist. Uh-huh.
I can think of a real world
of that. Which one?
Fast food?
Fast food?
Well, just the fact that I could be able to use it.
Uh-huh.
All they do is that you kind of press a button and instructions can get the food.
Mm-hmm.
To the level of the person at the cafe experience, all they know is that they hit buttons and then they turn around to get a hamburger or whatever that's being made. And then the level of the person actually having to put together the burger.
This idea of levels, of levels of information hiding and abstraction levels is prevalent through our society nowadays, as complicated as things have gotten. How do we actually do this? We can actually make a distinction here between information hiding and encapsulation. I'm not going to worry too much about that distinction. Information hiding is prevalent in just about all programming languages. Encapsulation is supported by some programming languages and not by others. By the most widely used languages and popular languages nowadays, encapsulation is supported. The Ada programming language has this concept of packages. C++ has its classes. Before C++, we had a limited form of encapsulation through separately compiled modules, which we will talk a little bit about in here, but not much, because they really only offered us limited encapsulation. The string data type that you've the string class that you've already been using, in a sense, that's an example of encapsulation. You aren't allowed to actually access the individual characters directly that's in the string. Now, what you might be thinking is, if you know as much as you probably should about the string class, you might say, well, now, wait a minute. I can take a string object, and I can actually index that so that I am accessing the individual characters directly. No, not really, because when you use the bracket operators to index an array object, those bracket operators actually correspond to a function that gets called in the string class. Okay? You do not actually access. It's not like an array, where with an array of characters, for example, if you use the brackets, the compiler will calculate the address directly of where that character is at in memory, and it'll allow you direct access to that character in memory. That's not true with the string class. The string class, the compiler doesn't do that. And we'll talk a little bit later on in here of how that happens. But if we don't know, you don't actually know how a string object is represented. It might be represented by an array of characters, and it might not. Okay? And actually a string object will grow. If you put characters into it, it'll have one size, and then you put more characters into it, and it'll grow. Okay? So it has to have some mechanism, some representation mechanism for growing during execution. We as users don't have to concern ourselves with that, though. That's the advantage of having the details hidden from us that we don't really need to know.
About the module offering calculation, was it in the original C or
No, they did not have all of the original capabilities. Originally in C, you could not include member functions in structs. That was added when C++ came along. Why they added it, I don't know. It's an abomination, okay? Don't use it. I think I've told you that before in here. All right. The mechanism in C++ that allows us to basically realize an abstract data type and be able to implement information hiding and encapsulation is this concept of the class construct. Now, Stristrup, Bjarne Stristrup, he was the guy who basically created C++. He did the development work on the add-on. He wasn't the only one. Some of you aren't quite old enough to realize this. Back in the early 90s, when he put forth his proposal for C++, there was another proposal out there from some other guys, Brad Myers and some guys at the University of Chicago, I believe, called Objective C. Okay? And at the time, neither one of them was the standard. There was no standard. None of the national standarding bodies had approved one or the other. Stristrup basically won out for a lot of various technical reasons. At the time, I didn't think it was going to. At the time, if I'd had to have bet my money on it, it's the one that would have became the standard. I was actually betting on Objective-C, and only for one real reason, and that's because of the Next Corporation. Steve Jobs went out after he left Apple and started the Next Corporation. You may have heard about that one. And they wrote their whole operating system basically in Objective-C. They had a compiler. They wrote a whole operating system that their machine was based upon. And I thought that gave that language, that version of C++, a lot of validity. It was a major development effort that had been written in this language and proved that it would work. But for a lot of technical reasons, C++ is now the accepted standard.
That's the standard, like
the ANSI, the American National Standard for Institute, and the ISO, the International Standards Organization, along with a lot of other standard organizations around the world. Companies submit things to them, and they go through a whole review and standardization process. And I'm not going to bother with that. It's too boring to talk about. Basically, the idea of the C++ is to allow you to implement a type just like a language defined type. And it actually has enough power in the language. Some would say too much power. But it has enough language power to allow you to implement your type to make them behave identically from someone else's viewpoint, from a user's viewpoint, identically in the way that the language-defined types work. And that's a big advantage. You have to realize, though, that a class is really just sort of the realization of an abstraction, a concept. And when you're solving problems, what you need to, and we won't do a lot of this because this gets into object-oriented design that we will talk about in the next course, that you'll take. You really want to start solving problems once you get into pure OO programming in terms of not thinking of, when you first think about the problem, you don't actually want to think about, okay, what's the first thing I need to do? What's the next thing I need to do? No. That's not the way you attack the problem. You attack the problem by thinking, okay, what are my objects that are in this problem? What are the things I'm manipulating, and how do I need to be able to manipulate them? And you design them. A lot of times that really gets to be quite simple because the problems correspond to some real world problems, and in the real world there are all kinds of objects. I mean, we've actually, you can write classes to essentially control like a microwave, to control a toaster. You can think of a toaster as an object. You can think of a dryer as an object. And then you can come up with a class to represent that, a set of operations to sort of mimic the user controls. Okay? And sometimes that gets to be quite easy. Sometimes it's not quite so easy to do. If you can do it well, it means that your program will be a very close match to the problem in terms of the representation and the solution that you've chosen. This mapping of the real-world entities onto these abstract classes will allow you to basically create a program that can be easily modified. We can get the language to do a lot of checking for us. It'll be easier for us to maintain the thing. It allows us to do code analysis. Gives us a lot of advantages that come about from this. So. A class type is very similar to a struct. A struct is a mechanism in the language for grouping together some heterogeneous, some different variable data types and referring to them by one name, right? A class is basically the same thing. The same way you declare a struct, you could actually declare a class. You could take the word struct and just replace it by class and you'd have a class. That's not taking full advantage of the class mechanism, but in reality, I mean, that's the simplest thing you can do. A class will have data elements called members, data members, any of the simple or other structure types, or even other objects of other classes. Just like structs, you can have one struct inside of another struct, so you have hierarchical records, right? You can do the same thing for classes. You can aggregate or associate your classes. We'll get into that in the next course. The classes can also contain functions, though. Those are called function members. And you can set the class up such that the language will provide an access mechanism that will prevent any of your other code from accessing those data members except through the function members. The only way that they will be able to gain access and manipulate those data objects, those data members, is through the function members. The function members then, in a sense, become the interface to the rest of the code to your class. Well, he asked basically what's the difference between struct and a class. That's actually a good question, especially when you consider that a struct can also have function members, right?
Can they also have private
members? No, they cannot. That's the big difference. Data members of a class by default are what's called private. They had this access level called private associated with them by default, unless you explicitly say that you want them to be public. Now, if they are private, then if you make them private, it means that they cannot be accessed outside of the class. Their scope is restricted to the class, which means they can only be accessed by the function members' code that's inside that class. That's the restriction. By default, a struct members are public, which means they can be accessed outside of it or inside of it. It doesn't matter. They can be accessed anywhere. In other words, the struct concept or construct doesn't have any access protection mechanisms, and that's the big advantage of classes over structs. Question?
What's protected?
Protected is a level of access between private and public. It's pseudo-private, if you want to think of it like that. It's where you will allow other classes that are in a class inheritance hierarchy you will allow them access to these protected members. They still can't access the private members, but you still won't allow other classes outside of the hierarchy to access it. Now, and that's all I'm going to say about protected members in here, all right? Because we aren't going to get into inheritance and polymorphism and things like that. That's for the next course in this sequence. A variable of a class is actually called an object. And when you define an object, you are a variable of a class, an instance of the class, you are said to be instantiating an object of that class. And that's important because the mere instantiation of an object will cause code to get executed. Unlike structs and unlike simple variables, when you define them, when you define a simple variable or you define a structure variable, code doesn't automatically get executed. No code really gets executed. The compiler might reserve storage for them. Okay, the type of storage depends upon their storage association. We won't worry about that at the moment. But code doesn't get executed. But when you instantiate an object of a class, code will automatically get executed. That's what makes it so important. So here on slide 2.10 is an example of a simple little date type class declaration. And you can see here, it looks very much like a structure. You can think of just taking the word struct and replacing it by class. Okay, you still have the curly brackets. And what's different though is where in a struct you would just have these variable declarations inside of the struct, its members that you would declare. Now you also put function prototypes inside of here. And usually the function prototypes will be public. Okay? The function prototypes will be public. They don't have to be. Some of the function prototypes could be private. If a function, let me go on here. These private data members, and all of your data members should be private. In reality, you can make those data members public. But if you do that, you aren't taking advantage of the encapsulation mechanism that's provided for you, the access restrictions that are set up in the language. And you might as well just be using structs if you're doing that. So you better have a very darn good reason, and I can hardly ever think of one, of why you should be declaring public data members inside of a class. Question?
How would you get access, for example, a private member of
in order to access it, these private members here can only be accessed by the code that's in these functions. They can only be accessed directly by that code. That's why you have to have certain functions like this, like year is, month is, and day is, that basically return back the values that are stored inside of here. That's the way that the user's code outside of the class, sometimes called the client code, figures out at times what values are stored in an object. In this case, a date object of type date type. That's the way you would gain access to them. Now, let's see here. There's some other thing. Oh yeah. If you actually declare a function prototype down in the private section, that means that function is a private function. Now, we just said that the private data members can only, which are really identifiers. Variables are identifiers, right? Actually, so are function names, right? Those are identifiers too. So if the private identifiers can only be accessed by the code of functions that are inside the class, if I take one of these function prototypes and I declare it down in the private section, that basically means that identifier for that function can only be accessed, which means the function can only be invoked from where? from other functions that are in the class. That means that function cannot be called by code outside of the class. And that's fine. That actually tends to be quite useful to do at times, because at times you may need to provide a fairly complex operation to your user, but you yourself may want to break that up into separate functions. So you do that, and you make them private, and you have the user's function actually calls those private functions to carry out the task. And they don't even have to know that you've actually sort of decomposed it that way. They don't have access to those individual private function members. That tends to be quite useful at times. This is a declaration. It doesn't reserve any storage. It's like when you declare a structure, you're actually just declaring a type. No storage gets reserved. No storage gets reserved until we actually instantiate an object of that class. And notice, of course, that only the prototypes go up here inside the class. The actual function definitions go elsewhere for the most part. There are one or two little exceptions to that. We'll get to those. As far as we're concerned in here, since we're only talking about single source code file compilation at the moment, your class declaration would go above main. And then the actual function implementations will go below main, just in sort of the same way that you're doing it now in reality. So in order to actually instantiate some objects of this type, we can then, once we've declared that class type, we can use that class type the same way as we would int or bool or double. We basically just use it as a type. And then we list identifiers, variables after it. And that instantiates the objects of that class. And it actually reserves storage at that point. Now, the way this class is set up at the moment, there's no default initializations being performed. That's actually true for structures at the moment. When you define a variable that's a structure, are the data members inside the structure, do they take on some default values? Not unless you sort of specify some initializers for them. If you don't specify initializers for them, they're undefined. There's a way around this in the class that we'll see. We can't, because these things are private, because the private data members have been restricted in terms of their access, we can't just say something like today.month=9 the way we would with a structure. That'll generate a compile time error. One of the ways that we could actually access those members, those private members, and give them values is by using this initialize function. Now, the initialize function is a member. It's a function member, and it's an identifier. In structures, in order to access a data member, you use the dot operator, right? And you list the identifier of the variable you're accessing that follows it. Same way for invoking member functions. And you've seen this before. You've been using it already. If you've been using the stream class or the streaming class, right? You actually have a stream object, and you'll say dot open or something, or you'll have the string, a stream object, and you'll say stream dot length or whatever, right? You actually invoke those member functions by using the little dot operator, but rather than actually accessing a data member identifier, you're just accessing a function identifier. So the access mechanism is the same. And this here, 9/28/1988, would set those today, it would set the month, day, and year in the today object to 9/28/1998. Now later, if a user wants to know what they've stored in that identifier or that object later, they can do that with this year is, day is, month is function. They cannot access those things directly. That should be fairly straightforward. Now, in order to actually define the functions that are members of a class, classes create a scoping level. And that allows us, just like structures, we can have the same identifier, we can use the same identifier names, be they data identifiers or function identifiers. We can use the same identifier names in one structure type that we use in a different structure type. We can do the same thing in classes. That's actually a big advantage, because a lot of times we might want to have more than one empty function in a program, or more than one length function in a program, where we want to be able to compute the length of this type of object or the length of this type of object. Well, they can have their own. And the way the compiler keeps them separated in terms of the function definition is when you define a function here, you have to precede the function name in its definition by the name of the class that it belongs to and the scope resolution operator, which is the two colons. So you still have to, otherwise the function definition, the function heading looks the same as it did previously. It should look the same as you've been used to doing it, where you've got the type first, the name of the function, and then the parameters. The only thing different here is you add, after the type, you add the class name and the scope resolution operator. That way, if there were multiple initialized functions, where we had two different or three different classes, and each of them contained their own initialized function, we could have the same initialized function, we could have all of those defined in the same source code file, and the language would know which one to connect them to by you telling it with the scope resolution operator. And you can see here, we've got the three parameters, new month, new day, new year, and we just set the corresponding private data members, which are year, month, and day, equal to those parameters. Now, let's see here. There's a lot of other, there is no design, there's no error checking here, there really should be. Post, you know, it sort of says self.year, self.month, self.day equals. Which year, month, and day are we talking about? Is it the year, month, and day of today, tomorrow, or another day? Okay, which one of them is it? Well, we don't need to know that right here when we're writing the function. When the function is invoked, it'll be invoked by a particular object. This object will actually, when you are invoking a function, if you want to state it the way the pure object-oriented purist would, you would say that you're asking this today object, you're sending it a message, and that message is initialized. You're asking it to initialize itself to these values. That actually becomes a bit important later on when we start talking about advanced OO programming concepts, because you, in actually requesting an object to do something, you don't really specifically need to know that you're requesting it to execute a particular function. And that object can actually choose, through some advanced language mechanisms, which function to execute based upon the message that you send it. Let's not worry about that. That gets pretty complex. Yes, it would. We're going to get to constructors here in just a second. In a sense, the initialize here is sort of a pseudo-constructor. Right? We'll get to that here in just a second. So, we don't have to worry about which one, because this object that invokes the function gets automatically passed by default to the function. And the compiler keeps track of which one invokes it, and the compiler basically, it figures out which function or which object is invoked it, so that this year, month, and day is referring to the correct data members of the particular or specific object that invoked it at any given time. How it does that is an entirely different matter. It's a matter for a compiler construction course, and I'm not going to go into it at the moment. Now, in terms of in terms of implementing this, we can actually just in a single source code file, we can have our class, then we would have main, maybe a bunch of other functions, and then we have our actual function definition here. For separate compilation, and we'll be talking about separate compilation in a couple weeks or so in here, a few weeks, maybe a month. We will actually use in the we will actually have a .h file and a .cpp file for each class that we create. Now, initially for the second program that you're going to be writing in here, you won't do this. For the second program that you're writing, you're still going to be using one source code file. You're going to be using this organization up above. But later on, with our third and fourth programs, for every class type that you'll have a .h file, which is where you'll put your class declaration, and a corresponding .cpp file, which is where you'll put your function definition. And your other files will use those by including them.
That's why we aren't doing
separate compilation until the last couple programs. Okay. Once Mr. Gates gives us some more money, we'll do some more work on the curator and make it handle separate compilation, but not at the moment. Okay. Now, we can actually build upon the class members' functions directly. The user of a class, if a class doesn't provide a certain functionality that they might need, well, they can implement functions that take objects of the class as parameters. Here, if we need a compare to function, to compare two objects, like two dates, for example, we might create a little enumerated type, precede, same as follows, and then we've got the relation type here that compared to will return, and it just takes a couple date objects, and it'll actually compare them. So it'll check if the year for date A precedes the year for date B, then it's going to return precede. The first date is less than the second date in a sense. Otherwise, if the year for the second date is greater than the first date is greater than the year for the second date, it follows it. Otherwise, the years would be equal, and we have to compare the months. And then the months might be equal, and we have to compare the days, and eventually if we get all the way down here at the bottom, they're going to be the same. So the logic of that, you should be able to follow, right? Nothing terribly complex about that. In order to use that code, we would basically define a couple of date objects, initialize them, and then we would say, you know, if compared to these two date objects here, tomorrow and another date equals same, we would see out, think about it, scarlet, whatever. I think this is Mr. McQueen showing his history, his Civil War history buff. I think those are the two dates for the beginning and ending of the Civil War, but I don't know. I'm not as big of a Civil War buff as he is, okay? So, here's another way that we might extend this. Maybe we want to be able to print a date out. Well, in order to print a date out, then we create this print date function. The print date function here takes a date object. It'll actually, the first thing it does is call a print month function, and it passes it the month to be printed. Now, is it passing it the actual month that's actually stored in that a date object? No, it's passing a copy of it. Okay? Passing a copy of that month, which for this purpose is certainly good enough. And the print month, of course, just prints out the month, doing a switch on the month. And then it prints out the day and then the year. Okay? So we could use this to print out a given date here. So that one will print out February 29th, 2000. Which was the first leap century in 300 years, but then you knew that, right? Every 4 years, we have a leap day, right? Because we supposedly go around the sun 365 and a quarter days. Well, it actually turns out we go a little bit less than a quarter day. So that means that every 4 years, when we're adding a whole day back, we're adding just a little bit too much. And that accumulates so that every century, we, even though centuries are evenly divisible by four, we don't have leap day. 1900, February 29th, 1900, didn't exist. February 29th, 1800, didn't exist. Before that, well, then you get into the changeover from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar, and it gets really complicated. But 2000, we did have a February 29th, 2000. When will be the next leap century? Most of us, unless somebody comes up with some really great inventions between then and now, we won't be around to see it, because it won't be until February 29th, 2400. Okay? Now, whatever. Now, we could, however, if we are not only the user of this date type class, but we are also the programmer, okay, or we know the programmer, maybe we're all working together in some big company to create some huge monstrosity of a program. And we say, well, we can create a compared to function for our for this date type. But it would be a lot better, actually. There's probably a good chance that maybe other programmers of this using the date type object will need it. And so we asked the programmer who created that thing to add it into the class. So they decide, okay, sounds like a good idea. So they add it into the class. In order to do that, that would mean that inside the class declaration, they would add this prototype here. Okay, they might add the enum above it, the relation type. They would add in this function prototype in the public access mechanisms and the public member list. And then they would add, then they would actually specify this compared to function with the what? Scope resolution operator, okay, to make sure that the compiler connects it inside the class. But now, the number of parameters goes down to one. Why? Previously, it had two. It only needs one because where does it get the other one from? It's the object that invokes it. Okay? It's the object that actually calls this function. So now when we compare year, month, and day, the first set of those comparisons, we don't need to qualify them with the name of an object preceding it. Now, and we don't need to invoke these member functions, year is, month is, and day is, to actually get back that year, month, and day. That'll be it. The year, month, and day that we're talking about here on the left is the year, month, and day of the object that invoked it, which in this example down here is tomorrow. Tomorrow is the object that invokes this one, and another day here is the object that gets passed to compare to. It becomes the actual parameter that matches up to the formal parameter here. Uh-huh.
At the bottom of that, you have to change where the disabled string.
A type, date type, colon, colon thing. If you include this actually in the class, yes. But if you include it above the class, no. And it would be more useful to include it above the class, because otherwise that would get to be a bit unwieldy here. There's one other thing to notice here, and that is this sort of alternative access. Because alternatively, we could say if year is less than other date dot year, we could replace the year is calls by other date dot year. We could replace the month is calls by other date dot month, and the same for day is. Now, am I lying? Which I have a tendency to do at times, because there's a flaw in my character. Okay. I'm reading a book right now where the main character, he keeps going along and he introduces himself to people and he says, there's a slight flaw in my character. He never does bother to tell them what that slight flaw is. Now we said that an object's data members can only be accessed by the function members of that class, right? So if I replace those for this other data object by a direct access, if I try to replace those calls to those member functions by direct access to the private data members, is that kosher? Is that allowed? Or does the language complain? How many thinks the language, the compiler would complain? How many thinks it's allowed? You're right. Now, can you tell me why? It's a now compared to is a member function of the class, which means that since it's a member function of the class, it has class scope in terms of its access, which means it can access private data members of objects of that class. And that does not necessarily just limit it to the private members of the invoking object. If there's another object that it knows about, in this case it does because of the parameter, it can automatically directly access those. That's not a violation of the encapsulation because we've explicitly stated here that compared to is a member of the class, right? Which is better might be the thing you're going to ask about. Which is the better way of doing it? Is that what, huh?
Not quite.
Well, let me answer that question first anyway, because that's an important question. Which should we do then? Should we invoke the functions here, or should we invoke the, or access it directly? It's a question of efficiency, and it's a question it's a question of program design, it's a question of style, it's a question of robustness, blah, blah, blah. It's the problem once you get to learn too much. You have too many things to consider a lot of times in terms of making decisions. To the point is sometimes it paralyzes you. You're afraid to make a decision. But in terms of efficiency, it would be a lot more efficient from a language perspective to just access it directly. That way we would avoid the call, the overhead of the function call. And for this case where all these functions are doing is just returning back the corresponding private data member, I would say it's okay. If those functions were doing something quite a bit more complicated, then we wouldn't really be able to easily just replace them by the access to the private data member. And we would have to actually even be careful if that private data member, if there was a private data member, let's say we extend the state class to handle, what do they call them, the UTC code dates, universal time code dates. That's where a date gets converted into an integer. Okay, and there's a fairly complex computation for doing such. Okay, and I'm not going to go into their usefulness or whatever. You can argue that yourself. But these do exist. And some programs use UTC code date representations rather than month, day, year. And some programs need to go back and forth. So what if we extended this date type class to where not only did it have month, day, and year stored in it, but it also had UTC code date as a data member stored in it? Well, now, we could, and if we needed to access that, we could in some of our other functions maybe just access it directly. However, what if the user, and maybe it's ourselves, if we're the programmer, what if we actually are computing that UTC code value? You actually compute it from month, day, and year values, but maybe we only compute it whenever it changes. Or whenever someone calls our UTC code function that returns the value. But we have it actually stored in there. Well, now then, if we later on in our class is fairly complex, if we then later on just access it directly and bypass the computation, now we may have a logic error in our code because it might have needed to get recomputed because of a change from month, day, and year from the last time it was computed. So most of the time, the real answer to that question is that if these are simple, what's called accessor functions, where all they're doing is returning back a non-computed private data member, it's okay at that point to just replace them by the actual access to the function to the data member. Of course, now you can only do that from other functions that are in the class. It's okay to do that. But if it's actually a data member that's being computed in some mechanism, it's probably not good to do that. Okay, you had a question. Well, go ahead. What does the const do? That's a good question. It makes a constant member function. If you'll notice, if we go back, you'll notice that initialize doesn't have that out from it. Basically, when you declare a constant integer, for example, what are you telling the compiler? That integer isn't going to change. Okay? Well, by using this modifier, and I tell you what, we're going to find out in here that the const modifier can be used at a lot of different places in the language. And we're going to learn how to use it appropriately because it will enable us to take full advantage of a lot of the error checking that the compiler can do for us if we use it correctly. In this case, by following the prototype by the keyword const, we're telling the compiler that this is a const member function, and therefore it will not be allowed to change any of the private data members. We're telling it we are not going to be changing any of the private data members inside of here. Now, the advantage of that is we design that up, we tell the compiler that. Then if we make a mistake, and even if it's a silly mistake, it's a typing mistake that ends up actually, and it's possible to make typing mistakes that end up actually being valid statements in the language. Okay? Don't believe me? Read the story about Mariner 7 or Mariner 10 that crashed on Mars back years ago in the 70s. It was due to somebody forgetting to put a comma in a Fortran statement. Turned the Fortran loop statement, which was a do statement, into an actual assignment statement. That loop was the thing that was to control the firing of the retro rockets. Those retro rockets were to fire a certain number of minutes. Of course, they couldn't really physically test it, right? It's something that couldn't be completely tested. So what happens? You know, they send it out, it travels these millions of miles, it enters into orbit, it starts descent, that code executes, the rockets fire, it hits the statement that says loop, except it's not a loop now. It says just assign this value. The computer says, okay, I've assigned it. I've got to the end of the loop. I'm going on. And so now instead of the rockets firing for so many minutes, they fired for a split second and then turned them off. As it was traveling on down, the computer was basically saying, everything's fine. I'm executing okay. And it said that for a few more minutes until it went flat, okay? And unfortunately, due to the time difference with the transmission, no way to correct that error. Okay, they found it months later. So by putting the word const in here, we can get the compiler to catch mistakes that we might accidentally make. If we, in designing our function, if we realize, well, here for this compared to function, we're just comparing the data members, we don't need to be changing them, so we'll tell the compiler it's const. Then if we make a mistake, the compiler will catch it. It'll say, wait a minute, you can't change that, you told me you weren't going to. And then we can go, oh yeah, that was dumb, we made a stupid typing mistake, okay? Otherwise, it wouldn't catch mistakes like that. And they end up being logic errors that can be hard to find in thousands of lines of code. All right, somebody else had, you had a question.
Would it be possible maybe so that this error, this call, can't access
objects created by the same class of different
objects?
Different objects. Well, I'm not sure why you want to say
So basically, you're wondering your question is, there a mechanism in the language that would prevent it from accessing directly the private data memories of any parameter objects that are passed to it? Now, of course, if they are objects of a different class, and that's quite possible and quite useful at times, you can pass other objects to other objects. Can those other objects access the private data members of objects of another class directly? No, they're not members of that class. I know most of C++. I'm not going to admit to knowing everything. The language is huge. And from my experience, I know of no mechanism in the language that would allow you to specify a way that would prevent a member function of a class from directly accessing an object parameter's data members of that same class. I know of no mechanism to do that. And I don't really know any good reason why it would need to prevent you, which is probably why there's not one in the language, would be my guess.
Get back to the concept.
Yes.
So anytime that function...
Anytime a function does not need to
change the values
of private data members, it should be specified by const. And as a matter of fact, when you start designing classes for us in the second program, I will have the GTAs look at your code, and they will look at your classes, and they'll go, that should have been a const there, and you didn't make that function const, minus whatever, okay? So you should...